Thank you for coming. Thank you for being here. My name is Neil Donald Walsh. The following audio program contains selections from Conversations with God, an Uncommon Dialogue, Book 2, concerning creating your future in the eternal moment, and Sane Sex, Sacred Sex. You are here by appointment, true, but still, you could have failed to show up. You could have decided not to. You chose instead to be here at the appointed hour, at the appointed place, for this program to come into your hands. So thank you. What you have here is that for which you have been looking, that for which you have been yearning for a very long time. What you have here is your latest, and for some of you, perhaps your first, very real contact with God. This is a contact, and it is very real. God is going to have an actual conversation with you now, through me. I wouldn't have said this a few years ago. I'm saying it now because I've already had such a dialogue, and I therefore know that such a dialogue is possible. Not only is it possible, it is happening all the time, just as this is happening right here, right now. My first experience of talking to God on your behalf occurred in 1992 and 93. I had written an angry letter to God, asking why my life had become such a monument to struggle and failure. My letter to God demanded to know why and what it took to make life work. To my astonishment, that letter was answered. How it was answered and what those answers were became a book, published in May 1995 under the title Conversations with God, Book 1. The process by which this information arrived was exquisitely simple. On a blank sheet of paper, I would merely write a question, any question, usually the first question that came to my head. And no sooner was the question written than the answer would form in my head, as if someone were whispering in my ear. I was taking dictation. With the exception of the few words I'm speaking now, all the material in this book was placed on paper between spring of 1993 and a little over a year later. I'd like to present it to you now, just as it came from me and was given to me. Well, it's Easter Sunday, 1993, and as instructed, I'm here. I am here, pencil in hand, writing pad before me, ready to begin. I suppose I should tell you, God asked me to be here. We had a date. On Easter Sunday, 1992, 1 year ago today, God began a dialogue with me. I know, that sounds ridiculous, but it's what happened. Not long ago, that dialogue ended. I was given instructions to take a rest, but told also that I had a date to return to this conversation this day. You have a date, too. You're keeping it right now. I'm clear that these words are being spoken not only to me, but to you through me. Apparently, you've been looking for God and for word from God for a very long time. So have I. Today, we shall find God together. That's always the best way to find God, you know, together. We shall never find God apart. I mean that two ways. I mean, we'll never find God so long as we are apart. For the first step in finding that we are not apart from God is finding that we are not apart from each other. And until we know and realize that all of us are one, we cannot know and realize that we and God are one. God is not apart from us, ever. And we only think we are apart from God. It's a common error. We also think we're apart from each other. And so the fastest way to find God, I've discovered, is to find each other, to stop hiding out from each other, and of course to stop hiding out from ourselves. The fastest way to stop hiding out is to tell the truth to everyone, all the time. Start telling the truth now and never stop. Begin by telling the truth to yourself about yourself. Then tell the truth to yourself about another. Then tell the truth about yourself to another. Then tell the truth about another to that other. And finally, tell the truth to everyone about everything. This program is about truth, not my truth, God's truth. Our initial dialogue, God's and mine, was concluded just a month ago. I assume this one will go just like the first. That is, I ask questions and God answers. I guess I'll stop and ask God right now. God, is this how it's going to go?
Yes.
I thought so.
Except that I'll bring some subjects up myself without you asking.
Why are you adding that twist here?
Because I asked you here. The first contact you started by yourself. This time you have no agenda. Except to do my will.
Yes, that's correct.
That, Neil, is a very good place to be. I hope you and others will go to that place often.
But I thought your will was my will. How could I not do your will if it's the same as mine?
That is an intricate question. And not a bad place to start. Not a bad place at all for us to begin this dialogue. Let's go back a few paces. I've never said that my will was your will.
Oh, yes, you have. You said to me very clearly, your will is my will.
Indeed. But that's not the same thing.
It's not. Could have fooled me.
When I say your will is my will, that is not the same thing as saying my will is your will. If you did my will all the time, there would be nothing more for you to do to achieve enlightenment. The process would be over. You would be already there. One day of doing nothing but my will would bring you enlightenment. If you had been doing my will all the years you've been alive, you'd hardly need to be involved in this project right now. So it's clear you have not been doing my will. In fact, most of the time you don't even know my will.
I don't.
No, you don't.
Well, then why don't you tell me what it is?
I do. You just don't listen. And when you do listen, you don't really hear. And when you do hear, you don't believe what you're hearing. And when you do believe what you're hearing, you don't follow instructions anyway. So to say that my will is your will is demonstrably inaccurate. On the other hand, your will is my will. First, because I know it. Second, because I accept it. Third, because I praise it. Fourth, because I love it. Fifth, because I own it. And call it my own. This means you have free will to do as you wish, and that I make your will mine through unconditional love. Now, for my will to be yours, you would have to do the same. First, you would have to know it. Second, you would have to accept it. Third, you would have to praise it. Fourth, you would have to love it. Finally, you would have to call it your own. In the whole history of your race, only a few of you have ever done this consistently. A handful of others have done it nearly always. Many have done it a great deal. A whole slew of people have done it from time to time. And virtually everyone has done it on rare occasion, although some have never done it at all.
Which category am I in?
Doesn't matter. Which category do you want to be in? From now on, isn't that the pertinent question?
Yes.
And your answer?
Well, I'd like to be in the first category. I'd like to know and do your will all the time.
That's laudable, commendable, and probably impossible.
Why?
Because you have far too much growing to do before you can claim that. Yet I tell you this, you could claim that. You could move to godhood this instant if you chose to. Your growth need not take so much time.
Well, then why has it taken it so much time?
Indeed, why has it? What are you waiting for? Surely you don't believe it is I holding you back?
No, I'm clear that I'm holding myself back.
Good. Clarity is the first step to mastery.
Well, I'd like to get to mastery. How do I get there? How do I do that?
Keep listening. That's exactly where I'm taking you.
I'm not sure where to begin.
Let's take time.
How much time do we need to take? It's already taken me 5 months to get here. I know that people listen to this and think it's all put down in one even, uninterrupted flow. They don't realize that 20 weeks separated the 32nd and 33rd paragraph of this program. They don't understand that sometimes the moments of inspiration are half a year apart. How much time do we have to take?
That's not what I meant. I mean, let's take time.
As our first subject, as a place to begin.
Oh, well, okay. But while we're on the subject, why are you so long between visits?
My dear and wonderful son, I am not long between visits. I am never not with you. You are simply not always aware.
Why? Why am I not aware of you if you're always here?
Because your life gets caught up in other things. Let's face it, you've had a pretty busy 5 months.
Oh, yes, I have. A lot's been going on.
And you've made these things more important than me.
It doesn't feel like my truth.
I invite you to look at your actions. You've been deeply involved in your physical life. You've paid very little attention to your soul.
Well, it's been a challenging period.
Yes, all the more reason to have included your soul in the process. These past months would have gone much more smoothly with my help. So may I suggest that you don't lose contact?
I try to stay close, but I seem to get lost, caught up, as you put it, in my own drama. And then somehow I don't find time for you. I don't meditate. I don't pray. I certainly don't write.
I know. It's an irony of life that when you need our connection the most, you step away from it.
How can I stop doing that?
Stop doing that?
That's just what I said, but how?
You stop doing that by stopping doing that.
Well, it's not that simple.
It is that simple.
I wish it were.
Then it really will be, because what you wish is my command. Remember, my cherished one, your desires are my desires. Your will is my will.
All right, okay. Then I wish for this conversation to be finished by March. It's October now, and I wish for no more 5-month gaps in the material coming.
So will it be.
Good.
Unless it's not.
Oh, man. Do we have to play these games?
No, but so far that's how you've decided to live your life. You keep changing your mind. Remember, life is an ongoing process of creation. You are creating your reality every minute. The decision you make today is often not the choice you make tomorrow. Yet here is the secret of all masters. Keep choosing the same thing.
Over and over again? Once is not enough?
Over and over until your will is made manifest in your reality. For some, that could take years. For some, months. For others, weeks. For those approaching mastery, days, hours, or even minutes. For masters, creation is instantaneous. You can tell you are on your way to mastery when you see the gap closing between willing and experiencing.
You said the decision you make today is often not the choice you make tomorrow. So what? Are you saying we should never indulge in a change of mind?
Change your mind all you want. Yet remember that with each change of mind comes a change in the direction of the whole universe. When you make up your mind about something, you set the universe into motion. Forces beyond your ability to comprehend, far more subtle and complex than you can imagine, are engaged in a process, the intricate dynamics of which you are only just now beginning to understand. These forces and this process are all part of the extraordinary web of interactive energies which comprise the entirety of existence, which you call life itself. They are, in essence, me.
So when I change my mind, I'm making it difficult for you, is that it?
Nothing is difficult for me. But you might be making things very difficult for yourself. Therefore, be of one mind and of single purpose about a thing. And don't take your mind off it until you have produced it in reality. Keep focused. Stay centered. This is what is meant by being single-minded. If you choose something, choose it with all your might, with all your heart. Don't be faint-hearted. Keep going. Keep moving toward it. Be determined.
Don't take no for an answer.
Exactly.
But what if no is the right answer? But what if what we want is not for us, not for our own good, not in our best interests? Then you won't give it to us, right?
Wrong. I will give you whatever you call forth, whether it's good for you or bad for you. Have you looked at your life lately?
But I've been taught that we can't always have what we desire. I mean, that God won't give it to us if it's not for our highest good.
That's something people tell you when they want you not to be disappointed with a particular outcome. First of all, let's move back to clarity about our relationship. I don't give you anything. You call it forth. Secondly, I don't make a judgment about what you call forth. I don't call a thing good or bad. You too would do well not to do so. You are a creative being, made in the image and likeness of God. You may have whatever you choose, but you may not have anything you want.
In fact, you'll never get anything you want if you want it badly enough.
I know. You've said that the act of wanting a thing pushes it away from us.
Yes. And do you remember why?
Because thoughts are creative, and the thought of wanting a thing is a statement to the universe, a declaration of a truth, which the universe then produces in my reality.
Precisely. Exactly. You have learned. You do understand. That's great. Yes, that's how it works. The moment you say, I want something, the universe says, indeed you do, and gives you that precise experience, the experience of wanting it. Whatever you put after the word I becomes your creative command. The genie in the bottle, which I am, exists but to obey. I produce what you call forth. You call forth precisely what you think, feel, and say. It's as simple as that.
So tell me again, why does it take so much time for me to create the reality I choose?
For a number of reasons. Because you do not believe you can have what you choose. Because you do not know what to choose. Because you keep trying to figure out what's best for you. Because you want guarantees ahead of time that all your choices will be good. And because you keep changing your mind.
Let me see if I understand. I shouldn't try to figure out what's best for me?
Best is a relative term, depending on 100 variables. That makes choices very difficult. There should be only one consideration on making any decision. Is this a statement of who I am? Is this an announcement of who I choose to be? All of life should be such an announcement. In fact, all of life is. You can allow that announcement to be made by chance or by choice. A life lived by choice is a life of conscious action. A life lived by chance is a life of unconscious reaction. Reaction is just that, an action you have taken before. When you react, what you do is assess the incoming data, search your memory bank for the same or nearly the same experience, and act the way you did before. This is all the work of the mind, not of your soul. Your soul would have you search its memory to see how you might create a truly genuine experience of you in the now moment. This is the experience of soul searching of which you have so often heard, but you have to be literally out of your mind to do it. When you spend your time trying to figure out what's best for you, you are doing just that, spending your time. Better to save your time than to spend it wastefully. It is a great time saver to be out of your mind. Decisions are reached quickly, choices are activated rapidly, because your soul creates out of present experience only, without review, analysis, and criticism of past encounters. Remember this. The soul creates. The mind reacts. The soul knows in its wisdom that the experience you are having in this moment is an experience sent to you by God before you had any conscious awareness of it. This is what is meant by a pre-sent experience. It's already on the way to you even as you are seeking it. For even before you ask, I shall have answered you. Every now moment is a glorious gift from God. That's why it is called the present. The soul intuitively seeks the perfect circumstance and situation now needed to heal wrong thought and bring you the rightful experience of who you really are. It is the soul's desire to bring you back to God, to bring you home to me. It is the soul's intention to know itself experientially, and thus to know me. For the soul understands that you and I are one, even as the mind denies this truth and the body acts out this denial. Therefore, in moments of great decision, be out of your mind and do some soul searching instead. The soul understands what the mind cannot conceive. You spend your time trying to figure out what's best for you. Your choices will be cautious. Your decisions will take forever. And your journey will be launched on a sea of expectations. If you are not careful, you will drown in your expectations.
Whew, that's quite an answer. But how do I listen to my soul? How do I know what I'm hearing?
The soul speaks to you in feelings. Listen to your feelings. Follow your feelings. Honor your feelings.
Why does it seem to me that honoring my feelings is precisely what has caused me to get into trouble in the first place?
Because you have labeled growth trouble and standing still safe. I tell you this, your feelings will never get you into trouble because your feelings are your truth. If you want to live a life where you never follow your feelings, but where every feeling is filtered through the machinery of your mind, go right ahead. Make your decisions based on your mind's analysis of the situation. But don't look for joy in such machinations, nor for celebration of who you truly are. Remember this. True celebration is mindless. If you listen to your soul, you will know what is best for you, because what is best for you is what is true for you. When you act only out of what is true for you, you speed your way down the path. When you create an experience based on your now truth, rather than react to an experience based on a past truth, you produce a new you. Why does it take so much time to create the reality you choose? This is why. Because you have not been living your truth. Know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. Yet once you come to know your truth, don't keep changing your mind about it. This is your mind trying to figure out what's best. Stop it. Get out of your mind. Get back to your senses. That is what is meant by getting back to your senses. It is a returning to how you feel, not how you think. Your thoughts are just that, thoughts. Mental constructions, made-up creations of your mind, but your feelings, now they are real. Feelings are the language of the soul, and your soul is your truth. There. Now does that tie it all together for you?
Does this mean we are to express any feelings, no matter how negative or destructive?
Feelings are neither negative nor destructive. They are simply truths. How you express your truth is what matters. When you express your truth with love, negative and damaging results rarely occur. And when they do, it is usually because someone else has chosen to experience your truth in a negative or damaging way. In such a case, there's probably nothing you can do to avoid the outcome. Certainly, failing to express your truth would hardly be appropriate. Yet people do this all the time. So afraid are they to cause or to face possible unpleasantness that they hide their truth altogether. Remember this. It is not nearly so important how well a message is received as how well it is sent. You cannot take responsibility for how well another accepts your truth. You can only ensure how well it is communicated. And by how well, I don't mean merely how clearly. I mean how lovingly, how compassionately, how sensitively, how courageously, and how completely. This leaves no room for half-truths, the brutal truth, or even the plain truth. It does mean the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help you God. It's the so help you God part that brings in the godly qualities of love and compassion. I will help you communicate in this way always if you will ask me. So yes, express what you call your most negative feelings, but not destructively. Failure to express or push out negative feelings does not make them go away. It keeps them in. Negativity kept in harms the body and burdens the soul.
But if another person hears every negative thought you have about that person, it would have to affect the relationship, no matter how lovingly those thoughts were delivered.
I said to express, push out, get rid of your negative feelings. I did not say how or to whom. All negativity need not be shared with the person about whom it is felt. It is only necessary to communicate these feelings to the other when failure to do so would compromise your integrity or cause another to believe an untruth. Negativity is never a sign of ultimate truth, even if it seems like your truth at the moment. It may arise out of an unhealed part of you. In fact, always it does. That is why it is so important to get these negativities out.
To release them. Only by letting go of them, putting them out there, placing them in front of you, can you see them clearly enough to know whether you really believe them. You have all said things, ugly things, only to discover that, once having been said, they no longer feel true. You have all expressed feelings from fear to anger to rage, only to discover that, once having been expressed, they no longer reveal how you really feel. In this way, feelings can be tricky. Feelings are the language of the soul, but you must make sure you are listening to your true feelings and not some counterfeit model constructed in your mind.
Oh, man. So now I can't even trust my feelings. Great. I thought that was the way to the truth. I thought that was what you were teaching me.
It is. I am. But listen, because it is more complex than you now understand. Some feelings are true feelings, that is, feelings born in the soul. And some feelings are counterfeit feelings. These are constructed in your mind. In other words, they are not feelings at all. They are thoughts. Thoughts masquerading as feelings. These thoughts are based on your previous experience and on the observed experience of others. You see someone grimace when having a tooth pulled. You grimace when having your tooth pulled. It may not even hurt, but you grimace anyway. Your reaction has nothing to do with reality, only how you perceive reality, based on the experience of others or on something that's happened to you in the past. The greatest challenge as human beings is to be here now. To stop making things up. Stop creating thoughts about a pre-sent moment, a moment you sent yourself before you had a thought about it. Be in the moment. Remember, you sent yourself this moment as a gift. The moment contained the seed of a tremendous truth. It is a truth you wish to remember. Yet when the moment arrived, you immediately began constructing thoughts about it. Instead of being in the moment, you stood outside the moment and judged it. Then you reacted. That is, you acted as you did once before. Now listen to these two words. Reactive, creative. Notice they are the same word, only the C has been moved. When you see things correctly, you become creative rather than reactive.
That's very clever.
Well, God is like that. But you see, the point I'm trying to make is that when you come to each moment cleanly, without a previous thought about it, you can create who you are, rather than reenact who you once were. Life is a process of creation, and you keep living it as if it were a process of reenactment.
But how can any rational human being ignore one's previous experience in the moment something occurs? I mean, isn't it normal to call up everything you know on the subject and respond from that?
It may be normal, but it is not natural. Normal means something usually done. Natural is how you are when you're not trying to be normal. Natural and normal are not the same thing. In any given moment, you can do what you normally do, or you can do what comes naturally. I tell you this, nothing is more natural than love. If you act lovingly, you will be acting naturally. If you react fearfully, resentfully, angrily, you may be acting normally, but you will never be acting naturally.
How can I act with love when all of my previous experience is screaming at me that a particular moment is likely to be painful?
Ignore your previous experience and go into the moment. Be here now. See what there is to work with right now in creating yourself anew. Remember, this is what you are doing here. You have come to this world in this way, at this time, in this place, to know who you are and to create who you wish to be. This is the purpose of all of life. Life is an ongoing, never-ending process of recreation. You keep recreating yourselves in the image of your next highest idea about yourselves.
But isn't that rather like the man who jumped off the highest building, sure that he could fly? He ignored his previous experience and the observed experience of others and jumped off the building, all the while declaring, "I am God." That doesn't seem very smart.
And I tell you this, men have achieved results much greater than flying. Men have healed sickness. Men have raised the dead.
One man has.
You think only one man has been granted such powers over the physical universe?
Only one man has demonstrated them.
Not so. Who parted the Red Sea?
God.
Indeed. But who called upon God to do that?
Moses.
Exactly. And who called upon me to heal the sick and raise the dead?
Jesus.
Yes. And now do you think what Moses and Jesus did, you cannot do?
But they didn't do it. They asked you to. That's a different thing.
Okay. We'll go with your construction for now. And do you think that you cannot ask me these same miraculous things?
I suppose I could.
And would I grant them?
I don't know.
That's the difference between you and Moses. That's what separates you from Jesus.
Many people believe if they ask in Jesus' name, you will grant their request.
Yes, many people do believe that. They believe they have no power, but they have seen, or believe others who have seen, the power of Jesus. So they ask in his name. Even though he said, "Why are you so amazed? These things and more shall you also do." Yet the people could not believe it. Many do not to this day. You all imagine you are unworthy. So you ask in the name of Jesus, or the Blessed Virgin Mary, or the patron saint of this or that, or the sun god, or the spirit of the east. You'll use anybody's name, anybody's, but your own. Yet I tell you this, ask and you shall receive. Seek and you shall find. Knock and it shall be open unto you.
Jump off the building and you shall fly.
There have been people who have levitated. Do you believe this?
Well, I've heard of it, I guess.
And people who have walked through walls and even left their bodies.
Yes, but I've never seen anybody walk through walls, and I don't suggest anyone try it. Nor do I think we should jump off buildings. That's probably not good for your health.
That man fell to his death not because he could not have flown if he were coming from the right state of being, but because he could never have demonstrated godliness by trying to show himself as separate from you.
Please explain.
The man on the building lived in a world of self-delusion in which he imagined himself to be other than the rest of you. By declaring, "I am God," he began his demonstration with a lie. He hoped to make himself separate, larger, more powerful. It was an act of the ego. Ego, that which is separate, individual, can never duplicate or demonstrate that which is one. By seeking to demonstrate that he was God, the man in the building demonstrated only his separateness, not his unity with all things. Thus, he sought to demonstrate godliness by demonstrating ungodliness and failed. Jesus, on the other hand, demonstrated godliness by demonstrating unity. And seeing unity and wholeness wherever and upon whomever he looked. In this his consciousness and my consciousness were one, and in such a state whatever he called forth was made manifest in his divine reality in that holy moment.
I see. So all it takes is Christ consciousness to perform miracles. Well, that should make things simple.
Actually, it does. More simple than you think. And many have achieved such consciousness. Many have been Christed, not just Jesus of Nazareth. You can be Christed too.
How?
By seeking to be. By choosing to be. But it is a choice you must make every day, every minute. It must become the very purpose of your life. It is the purpose of your life. You simply do not know it. And even if you know it, even if you remember the exquisite reason for your very existence, you do not seem to know how to get there from where you are.
Yes, that is the case. So how can I get from where I am to where I want to be?
I tell you this, again. Seek and ye shall find. Knock and it shall be opened unto you.
I've been seeking and knocking for 35 years. You'll pardon me if I'm a little bored with that line.
If not to say disillusioned, yes.
Hmm.
But really, while I have to give you good grades for trying, an A for effort, so to speak, I can't agree with you that you've been seeking and knocking for 35 years. Let's agree that you've been seeking and knocking on and off for 35 years, mostly off. In the past, when you were very young, you came to me only when you were in trouble, when you needed something. As you grew older and matured, you realized that was probably not a right relationship with God, and sought to create something more meaningful. Even then, I was hardly more than a sometimes thing. Still later, as you came to understand that union with God can be achieved only through communion with God, you undertook the practices and behaviors that could achieve communion, yet even these you engaged sporadically, inconsistently. You meditated, you held ritual, you called me forth in prayer and chant, and you evoked the spirit of me in you, but only when it suited you, only when you felt inspired to. And glorious as your experience of me was, even on these occasions, still you've spent 95% of your life caught up in the illusion of separateness. And only flickering moments here and there in the realization of ultimate reality. You still think that your life is about car repairs and telephone bills and what you want out of relationships. That it's about the dramas you've created rather than the creator of those dramas. You have yet to learn why you keep creating your dramas. You're too busy playing them out. You say you understand the meaning of life, but you do not live your understandings. You say you know the way toward communion with God, but you do not take that way. You claim you're on the path, but you do not walk it. Then you come to me and say you've been seeking and knocking for 35 years. I hate to be the one to disillusion you, but it's time you stop being disillusioned in me and started seeing you as you really are. Now, I tell you this. You want to be Christed? Act like Christ. Every minute of every day. It's not that you don't know how. He has shown you the way. Be like Christ in every circumstance. It's not that you can't. He has left you instructions. You are not without help in this, should you seek it. I'm giving you guidance every minute of every day. I am the still small voice within which knows which way to turn, which path to take, which answer to give, which action to implement, which word to say, which reality to create if you truly seek communion and unity with me. Just listen to me.
I guess I just don't know how to do that.
Ah, nonsense. You're doing it right now. Simply do it all the time.
But I can't walk around with a yellow legal pad every minute of the day. I can't stop everything and start writing notes to you, hoping you'll be there with one of your brilliant answers.
Thank you. They are brilliant. And here's another one. Yes, you can. I mean, if someone told you that you could have a direct connection with God, a direct link, a direct line, and all you had to do was make sure you had paper and pen handy at all times, would you do it?
Well, yes, of course.
Yet you just said you wouldn't or can't. So what's the matter with you? What are you saying? What is your truth? Now, the good news is that you don't even need a pad and pen. I am with you always. I don't live in the pen. I live in you.
That is true, isn't it? I mean, I can really believe that, can't I?
Of course you can believe it. It's what I've been asking you to believe from the beginning. It's what every master, including Jesus, has said to you. It is the central teaching. It is the ultimate truth. I am with you always, even unto the end of time. Do you believe this?
Yes. Yes, now I do. More than ever, I mean.
Good. Then use me. If it works for you to take out a pad and a pen, and I must say that seems to work pretty well for you, then take out a pad and a pen. More often. Every day. Every hour, if you have to. Get close to me. Get close to me. Do what you can. Do what you have to. Do what it takes. Say a rosary, kiss a stone, bow to the east, chant a chant, swing a pendulum, test a muscle, or write a book. Do what it takes. Each of you has your own construction. Each of you has understood me, created me in your own way. To some of you, I am a man. To some of you, I am a woman. To some, I am both. To some, I am neither. To some of you, I am pure energy. To some, the ultimate feeling, which you call love. And some of you have no idea what I am. You simply know that I am. And so it is. I am. I am the wind which rustles your hair. I am the sun which warms your body. I am the rain which dances on your face. I am the smell of flowers in the air. And I am the flowers which send their fragrance upward. I am the air which carries the fragrance. I am the beginning of your first thought. I am the end of your last. I am the idea which sparked your most brilliant moment. I am the glory of its fulfillment. I am the feeling which fueled the most loving thing you ever did. I am the part of you which yearns for that feeling again and again. Whatever works for you, whatever makes it happen, whatever ritual, ceremony, demonstration, meditation, thought, song, word, or action it takes for you to reconnect, do this. Do this in remembrance of me.
So, going back and summarizing what you're telling me, I seem to come up with these main points. Life is an ongoing process of creation. A secret of all masters is to stop changing one's mind, keep choosing the same thing. Don't take no for an answer. We call forth what we think, feel, and say. Life is a process of creation or reaction. The soul creates, the mind reacts. The soul understands what the mind cannot conceive. Stop trying to figure out what is best for you, how you can win the most, lose the least, get what you want, and start going with what feels like who you are. Your feelings are your truth. What is best for you is what is true for you. Thoughts are not feelings. Rather, they are ideas of how you should feel. When thoughts and feelings get confused, truth becomes clouded, lost. To get back to your feelings, be out of your mind and get back to your senses. Once you know your truth, live it. Negative feelings are not true feelings at all. Rather, they are your thoughts about something, based always on the previous experience of yourself and others. Previous experience is no indicator of truth, since pure truth is created here and now, not reenacted. To change your response to anything, be in the present, that is, the pre-sent moment, the moment that was sent to you and was what it was before you had a thought about it. In other words, be here now, not in the past or the future. The past and the future can exist only in thought. The pre-sent moment is the only reality. Stay there. Seek and you shall find. Do whatever it takes to stay connected with God, Goddess, Truth. Don't stop the practices, the prayers, the rituals, the meditations, the readings, the writings, the whatever works for you to stay in touch with all that is. How's that so far?
Great. So far, so good. You've got it. Now, can you live it?
I'm going to try.
Good.
Now, can we go to where we left off? Tell me about time.
There is no time like the present. You've heard that before, I'm sure. But you didn't understand it. Now you do. There is no time but this time. There is no moment but this moment. Now is all there is.
What about yesterday and tomorrow?
Figments of your imagination, constructions of your mind, non-existent in ultimate reality. Everything that ever happened, is happening, and ever will happen, is happening right now.
I don't understand.
And you can't, not completely, but you can begin to, and a beginning grasp is all that is needed here. So, just listen. Time is not a continuum. It is an element of relativity that exists vertically, not horizontally. Don't think of it as a left-to-right thing, a so-called timeline that runs from birth to death for each individual and from some finite point to some finite point in the universe. Time is an up-and-down thing. Think of it as a spindle representing the eternal moment of now. Now picture leaves of paper on the spindle, one atop the other. These are the elements of time, each element separate and distinct, yet each existing simultaneously with the other. All the paper on the spindle at once, as much as there will ever be, as much as there ever was. There is only one moment, this moment, the eternal moment of now. It is right now that everything is happening, and I am glorified. There is no waiting for the glory of God. I made it this way because I just couldn't wait. I was so happy to be who I am that I just couldn't wait to make that manifest in my reality. So boom, here it is, right here, right now, all of it. There is no beginning to this, and there is no end. It, the all of everything, just is. Within the isness is where your experience and your greatest secret lies. You can move in consciousness within the isness to any time or place you choose.
You mean we can time travel?
Indeed, and many of you have. All of you have, in fact. And you do it routinely, usually in what you call your dream state. Most of you are not aware of it. You cannot retain the awareness. But the energy sticks to you like glue. And sometimes there's enough residue that others, sensitive to this energy, can pick up things about your past or your future. They feel or read this residue. And you call them seers and psychics. Sometimes there is enough residue that even you in your limited consciousness are aware you've been here before. Your whole being is suddenly jarred by the realization that you've done all this before.
Deja vu.
Yes. Or that wonderful feeling when you meet someone that you've known them all your life.
Mm.
Known them for all eternity. That's a spectacular feeling. That's a marvelous feeling. And that's a true feeling. You have known that soul forever. Forever is a right now thing. So you have often looked up or looked down from your piece of paper on the spindle and seen all the other pieces. And you've seen yourself there because a part of you is on every piece.
How is that possible?
I tell you this, you have always been, are now, and always will be. There has never been a time when you were not, nor will there ever be such a time.
But wait. What about the concept of old souls? Aren't some souls older than others?
Nothing is older than anything.
I created it all at once, and all of it exists right now. The experience of older and younger to which you refer has to do with the levels of awareness of a particular soul or aspect of being. You're all aspects of being, simply parts of what is. Each part has the consciousness of the whole embedded within it. Every element carries the imprint. Awareness is the experience of that consciousness being awakened. The individual aspect of the all becomes aware of itself. It becomes, quite literally, self-conscious. And gradually it becomes conscious of all others, and then of the fact that there are no others, that all is one. Then, ultimately, of me, magnificent me.
Boy, you really like you, don't you?
Don't you?
Well, yes. I think you're great.
I agree. I think you're great. That's the only place where you and I disagree. You don't think you're great.
How can I see myself as great when I see all my foibles, all my mistakes, all my evil?
I tell you this, there is no evil.
I wish that could be true.
You are perfect just as you are.
I wish that could be true, too.
It is true. A tree is no less perfect because it is a seedling. A tiny infant is no less perfect than a grown-up. It is perfection itself. Because it cannot do a thing, does not know a thing, that does not make it somehow less perfect. A child makes mistakes. She stands, she toddles, she falls. She stands again, a bit wobbly, hanging onto her mommy's leg. Does that make the child imperfect? I tell you, it is just the opposite. That child is perfection itself, wholly and completely adorable. So, too, are you.
But the child hasn't done anything wrong. The child hasn't consciously disobeyed, hurt another, damaged herself.
The child doesn't know right from wrong.
Precisely.
Neither do you.
But I do. I know it's wrong to kill people, and that it's right to love them. I know it's wrong to hurt and right to heal, to make things better. I know it's wrong to take what's not mine, to use another, to be dishonest.
I could show you instances where each of those wrongs would be right.
You're playing with me now.
Not at all. Merely being factual.
If you're saying there are exceptions to every rule, then I agree.
If there are exceptions to a rule, then it is not a rule.
Are you telling me that it's not wrong to kill, to hurt, to take from another?
That depends on what you are trying to do.
Okay, I get it. But that doesn't make these things good. Sometimes one has to do bad things to achieve a good end.
Which doesn't make them bad things at all, then, does it? They are just means to an end.
Are you saying the end justifies the means?
What do you think?
No, absolutely not.
So be it. Don't you see what you're doing here? You're making up the rules as you go along. And don't you see something else? That's perfectly okay. It's what you're supposed to be doing. All of life is a process of deciding who you are and then experiencing that. As you keep expanding your vision, you make up new rules to cover that. As you keep enlarging your idea about yourself, you create new do's and don'ts, yeses and no's to encircle that. These are the boundaries that hold in something which cannot be held in. You cannot hold in you because you are as boundless as the universe. Yet you can create a concept about your boundless self by imagining and then accepting boundaries. In a sense, this is the only way you can know yourself as anything in particular. That which is boundless is boundless. That which is limitless is limitless. It cannot exist anywhere because it is everywhere. If it is everywhere, it is nowhere in particular. God is everywhere. Therefore, God is nowhere in particular, because to be somewhere in particular, God would have to not be somewhere else, which is not possible for God. There's only one thing that is not possible for God, and that is for God to not be God. God cannot not be, nor can God not be like itself. God cannot un-God itself. I am everywhere, and that's all there is to it. And since I am everywhere, I am nowhere. And if I am nowhere, where am I? Now, here.
I love it. You made this point before, but I love it, so I let you go on.
That's very kind of you. And do you understand it better now? Do you see how you have created your ideas of right and wrong simply to define who you are? Do you see that without these definitions, boundaries, you are nothing? And do you see that, like me, you keep changing the boundaries as you change your ideas of who you are?
Well, I get what you're saying, but it doesn't seem that I've changed the boundaries, my own personal boundaries, very much. To me, it's always been wrong to kill. It's always been wrong to steal. It's always been wrong to hurt another. The largest concepts by which we govern ourselves have been in place since the beginning of time. And, you know, most human beings agree on them.
Then why do you have war?
Well, because there will always be some who break the rules. There's a rotten apple in every barrel.
What I'm going to tell you now and in the passages which follow might be very difficult for some people to understand and accept. It is going to violate much of what is held as truth in your present thought system. Yet I cannot let you go on living with these constructions if this dialogue is to serve you. So we must now, in this second book, meet some of these concepts head on. It's going to be bumpy going here for a while. Are you ready?
I think so, yes. Thanks for the warning. But what is it that's so dramatic or difficult to understand or accept that you're going to tell me?
I'm going to tell you this. There are no rotten apples. There are only people who disagree with your point of view on things. People who construct a different model of the world. I'm going to tell you this. No persons do anything inappropriate given their model of the world.
Well, then their model is all messed up. I know what's right and wrong, and because some other people don't, that doesn't make me crazy. Because I do, they're the ones who are crazy.
I'm sorry to say, that's exactly the attitude which starts wars.
I know. I was doing that on purpose. I was just repeating here what I've heard many other people say. But how can I answer like that? I mean, how can I answer people who talk that way? What could I say?
You could tell them that people's ideas of right and wrong change and have changed over and over again from culture to culture, time period to time period, religion to religion, place to place, even from family to family and person to person.
You could point out to them that what many people considered right at one time, burning people at the stake for what was considered witchcraft, as an example, is considered wrong today. You could tell them that a definition of right and wrong is a definition established not only by time, but also by simple geography. You could allow them to notice that some activities on your planet, prostitution for instance, are illegal in one place and just a few miles down the road, legal in another. And so whether a person is judged as having done something wrong is not a matter of what that person has actually done, but of where he has done it. Now, I'm going to repeat something I said in Book 1, and I know that it was very, very difficult for some to grasp, to understand. Hitler went to heaven.
I'm not sure people are ready for this.
The purpose of this program, and of all the books in the trilogy we are creating, is to create readiness. Readiness for a new paradigm. A new understanding, a larger view, a grander idea.
Well, I'm going to have to ask the questions here that I know so many people are thinking and wanting to ask. How could a man like Hitler have gone to heaven? Every religion in the world, I would think everyone, has declared him condemned and sent straight to hell.
First, he could not have gone to hell because hell doesn't exist. Therefore, there is only one place left to which he could have gone, but that begs the question. The real issue is whether Hitler's actions were wrong. Yet I have said over and over again that there is no right or wrong in the universe. A thing is not intrinsically right or wrong. A thing simply is. Now, your thought that Hitler was a monster is based on the fact that he ordered the killing of millions of people, correct?
Obviously, yes.
Yet what if I told you that what you call death is the greatest thing that could happen to anyone? What then?
I'd find that hard to accept.
You think that life on earth is better than life in heaven? I tell you this, at the moment of your death, you will realize the greatest freedom, the greatest peace, the greatest joy, and the greatest love you have ever known. Shall we therefore punish Br'er Fox for throwing Br'er Rabbit into the briar patch?
You're ignoring the fact that, however wonderful life after death may be, our lives here should not be ended against our will. We came here to achieve something, to experience something, to learn something. And it's not right that our lives be cut short by some maniacal hoodlum with insane ideas.
First of all, you're not here to learn anything. Life is not a school. And your purpose here is not to learn. It is to remember. And on your larger point, life is often cut short by many things, a hurricane, an earthquake.
That's different. You're talking about an act of God.
Every event is an act of God. Do you imagine that an event could take place if I did not want it to? Do you think that you could so much as lift your little finger if I chose for you not to? You can do nothing if I'm against it. Yet let us continue to explore this idea of wrongful death together. Is it wrong for life to be cut short by disease?
Wrong isn't a word that applies to here. Those are natural causes. That's not the same as a human being like Hitler, murdering people.
What about an accident? A stupid accident?
Same thing. It's unfortunate, tragic, but that's the will of God. We can't peer into God's mind and find out why these things happen. We ought not even try, because God's will is immutable and incomprehensible. To seek to unravel divine mystery is to lust for knowledge beyond our ken. It is sinful.
How do you know?
Because if God wanted us to understand all of this, we would. The fact that we don't, can't, is evidence that it is God's will that we don't.
I see. The fact that you don't understand it is evidence of God's will. The fact that it happens is not evidence of God's will.
I guess I'm not very good at explaining some of this, but I know what I believe.
Do you believe in God's will, that God is all-powerful?
Yes.
Except where Hitler was concerned. What happened there was not God's will.
No.
How can that be?
Well, Hitler violated the will of God.
Now, how do you think he could do that if my will is all-powerful?
You allowed him to.
If I allowed him to, then it was my will that he should.
It would seem that way. But what possible reason could you have? No. It was your will that he have free choice, and it was his will that he do what he did.
You're so close on this. So close. You're right, of course. It was my will that Hitler, that all of you, have free choice. But it is not my will that you be punished unceasingly, unendingly, if you do not make the choice I want you to make. If that were the case, how free have I made your choice? Are you really free to do what you want if you know you'll be made to suffer unspeakably if you do not do what I want? What kind of choice is that?
It isn't a question of punishment. It's just natural law. It's simply a question of consequences.
I see you've been schooled well in all the theological constructions that allow you to hold me as a vengeful God without making me responsible for it. But who made these natural laws? And if we can agree that I must have put them into place, why would I put into place such laws and give you the power to overcome them? If I didn't want you affected by them, if it was my will that my wonderful beings never should suffer, why would I create the possibility that you could? And then, why would I continue to tempt you day and night to break the laws I've set down?
You don't tempt us. The devil does.
There you go again, making me not responsible. Don't you see that the only way you can rationalize your theology is to render me powerless? Do you understand that the only way your constructions make sense is if mine don't? Are you really comfortable with the idea of a God who creates a being whose actions it cannot control?
I didn't say you can't control the devil. You can control everything. You're God. It's just that you choose not to. You allow the devil to tempt us, to try to win our souls.
But why? Why would I do that if I don't want to have you not return to me?
Because you want us to come to you out of choice, not because there's no choice. Look, you set up heaven and hell so there could be a choice, so we could act out of choosing, not out of simply following a path because there's no other.
I can see how you've come to this idea. That's how I've set it up in your world, so you think that's how it must be in mine. In your reality, good cannot exist without bad, so you believe it must be the same in mine. I tell you this, there is no bad where I am, and there is no evil. There is only the all of everything, the oneness, and the awareness, the experience of that. Mine is the realm of the absolute, where one thing does not exist in relationship to another, but quite independent of anything. Mine is the place where all there is love.
And there are no consequences to anything we think, say, or do on Earth?
Oh, but there are consequences. Look around you.
No, I mean after death.
There is no death. Life goes on forever and ever. Life is. You simply change form.
All right, have it your way. After we change form.
After you change form, consequences cease to exist. There is just knowing. Consequences are an element of relativity. They have no place in the absolute because they depend on linear time and sequential events. These do not exist in the realm of the absolute. In that realm, there is naught but peace and joy and love. In that realm, you will know at last the good news.
That your devil does not exist. That you are who you always thought you were. Goodness and love. Your idea that you might be something else has come from an insane outer world causing you to act insanely. An outer world of judgment and condemnation. Others have judged you, and from their judgments you have judged yourself. Now you want God to judge you, and I will not do it. And because you cannot understand a God who will not act as humans would, you're lost. Your theology is your attempt to find yourself again.
You call our theologies insane, but how can any theology work without a system of reward and punishment?
Everything depends on what you perceive to be the purpose of life, and therefore the basis of the theology. If you believe life exists as a test, a trial, a period of putting you through your paces to see if you are worthy, your theologies begin to make sense. If you believe that life exists as an opportunity, a process through which you discover, remember that you are worthy and have always been, then your theologies seem insane. If you believe God is an ego-filled God who requires attention, adoration, appreciation, and affection, and will kill to get it, your theologies start to hold together. If you believe that God is without ego or need, but the source of all things, and the seed of all wisdom and love, then your theologies fall apart. If you believe that God is a vengeful God, jealous in his love and wrathful in his anger, then your theologies are perfect. If you believe God is a peaceful God, joyous in her love and passionate in her ecstasy, then your theologies are useless. I tell you this, the purpose of life is not to please God. The purpose of life is to know and to recreate who you are. In so doing, you do please God and glorify her as well.
Why do you keep saying her? Are you a she?
I'm neither a he nor a she.
Occasionally, I use the feminine pronoun to jar you out of your parochial thinking. If you think God is one thing, then you will think God is not another, and that would be a large mistake. Hitler went to heaven for these reasons. There is no hell, so there is no place else for him to go. His actions were what you would call mistakes, the actions of an unevolved being, and mistakes are not punishable by condemnation, but dealt with by providing the chance for correction, for evolution. Those souls were released from their earthly bondage like butterflies emerging from a cocoon. The people who were left behind mourn those deaths only because they do not know of the joy into which those souls entered. No one who has experienced death ever mourns the death of anyone. Your statement that their deaths were nevertheless untimely and therefore somehow wrong suggests that something could happen in the universe when it is not supposed to. Yet given who and what I am, that is impossible. Everything occurring in the universe is occurring perfectly. God hasn't made a mistake in a very long time. When you see the utter perfection in everything, not just those things with which you agree, but, and perhaps especially, those things with which you disagree, you achieve mastery.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about some of the very complex theologies we human beings have created. For instance, I was taught as a child that I was a sinner, that all human beings are sinners, that we can't help it. We're born that way. We're born into sin.
Quite an interesting concept. How did anyone get you to believe that?
Well, they told us the story of Adam and Eve. They told us in 4th, 5th, 6th grade catechism that, well, that we may not have sinned, and certainly babies haven't, but Adam and Eve did. And we're their descendants and have thus inherited their guilt as well as their sinful natures. You see, Adam and Eve ate of the forbidden fruit, partook of the knowledge of good and evil, and thus sentenced all of their heirs and descendants to separation from God at birth. All of us are born with this original sin on our souls. Each of us shares in the guilt, so we're given free choice to see, I guess, if we'll still do the same stuff Adam and Eve did and disobey God, or if we can overcome our natural inherited tendency to do bad and do the right thing instead, in spite of the world's temptations.
And if you do bad?
Well, then you send us to hell.
I do.
Yes, unless we repent.
I see.
If we say we're sorry, make a perfect act of contrition, you will save us from hell, but not from all suffering. We still have to go to purgatory for a while to cleanse us of our sins.
How long will you have to dwell in purgatory?
It depends. We have to have our sins burned away. It's not too pleasant, I can tell you. And the more sins you've got, the longer it takes to burn them out, the longer we stay. That's what I've been told.
I understand.
But at least we won't go to hell, which is forever. On the other hand, if we die in mortal sin, we go straight to hell.
Mortal sin?
Well, as opposed to venial sin. See, if we die with a venial sin on our soul, we only go to purgatory. Mortal sin sends us right to hell.
Can you give me an example of these various categories of sin you were told about?
Sure. Mortal sins are serious, kind of like major crimes, theological felonies, things like murder, rape, stealing. Venial sins are rather minor, theological misdemeanors. A venial sin would be like missing church on Sunday, or in the old days, eating meat on Friday.
Wait a minute. This God of yours sent you to purgatory if you ate meat on Friday?
Yeah. But not anymore, not since the early 60s. But if we ate meat on Fridays before the early 60s, woe be unto us.
Really?
Absolutely.
Well, what happened in the early 60s to make this sin no longer a sin?
Well, the Pope said it was no longer a sin.
I see. And this God of yours, he forces you to worship him, to go to church on Sundays, under pain of punishment?
Well, failure to attend Mass is a sin, yes. And if it's not confessed, if you die with that sin on your soul, you'll have to go to purgatory. Yeah.
But what about a child? What about an innocent little child who doesn't know all these rules by which God loves?
Well, if a child dies before it's baptized into the faith, that child goes to limbo.
Goes to where?
Limbo. It's not a place of punishment, but it's not heaven either. It's well, limbo. You can't be with God, but at least you don't have to go to the devil.
But why couldn't that beautiful, innocent child be with God? The child did nothing wrong.
Well, that's true, but the child was not baptized. See, no matter how faultless or innocent babies are, or any persons for that matter, they have to be baptized to get into heaven. Otherwise, God can't accept them. That's why it's important to have your children baptized quickly, soon after birth.
Who told you all this?
God, for his church.
Which church?
The Holy Roman Catholic Church, of course. That is God's church. In fact, if you're a Catholic and you should happen to attend another church, that's also a sin.
I thought it was a sin not to go to church.
Well, it is. It's also a sin to go to the wrong church.
What's a wrong church?
Any church that's not Roman Catholic. You can't be baptized in the wrong church. You can't get married in the wrong church. You can't even attend the wrong church. Now, I know this for a fact, because as a young man, I wanted to go with my parents to the wedding of a friend. I was actually asked to be in the wedding as an usher. But the nuns told me I shouldn't accept the invitation because it was in the wrong church.
Mm-hmm. Did you obey them?
The nuns? No. I figured God, you, would show up at the other church just as willingly as you showed up at mine, so I went. I stood in the sanctuary in my tuxedo, and I felt fine.
Good. Well, let's see now. We have heaven, we have hell, we have purgatory, we have limbo, we have mortal sin, we have venial sin. Is there anything else?
Well, there's confirmation and communion and confession. There's exorcism and extreme unction. There's patron saints and holy days of obligation.
Every day is sanctified. Every minute is holy. This now is the holy instant.
Well, yes, but some days are really holy. You know, the holy days of obligation. And on those days, you also have to go to church.
Here we go with the have-tos again. What happens if you don't?
It's a sin.
So you go to hell?
Well, no. You go to purgatory if you die with that sin on your soul. That's why it's good to go to confession. Really, as often as you can. Some people go every week. Some people every day. That way they can wipe the slate clean, keep it clean, so they could, if they happen to die or something.
Wow. Talk about living in constant fear.
Well, yeah. But you see, that's the purpose of religion. To put the fear of God into us. Then we do right and resist temptation.
Uh-huh. But now, what if you do commit a sin between confessions and then get into an accident or something and die?
Oh, it's okay. No panic. Just make a perfect act of contrition. Oh, my God, I am heartily sorry for having offended thee.
Okay. Enough.
But wait. That's just one of the world's religions. Don't you want to look at some others?
No, I get the picture.
Well, I hope that people don't think I'm simply ridiculing their beliefs.
You're really ridiculing no one, just saying it like it is. It's as American President Harry Truman used to say. Give them hell, Harry, people would shout, and Harry'd say, I don't give them hell, I just quote them directly, and it feels like hell.
Boy, we really got sidetracked there. We started out talking about time and ended up talking about organized religion.
Yes, well, that's what it's like talking with God.
It's hard to keep the dialogue limited.
Well, let me see if I can summarize the points you're making. There is no time but this time. There's no moment but this moment. Time is not a continuum. It's an aspect of relativity that exists in an up-and-down paradigm, with moments or events stacked on top of each other, happening or occurring at the same time. We are constantly traveling between realities in this realm of time, no time, all time, usually in our sleep. Déjà vu is one way we are made aware of this. There has never been a time when we were not, nor will there ever be. The concept of age, as it relates to souls, really has to do with levels of awareness, not length of time. There is no evil. We are perfect just as we are. Wrong is a conceptualization of the mind, based in relative experience. We're making up the rules as we go along, changing them to fit our present reality, and that's perfectly all right. It's as it should be, must be, if we are to be evolving beings. Hitler went to heaven. Everything that happens is God's will. Everything. That includes not just hurricanes, tornadoes, and earthquakes, but Hitler as well. The secret of understanding is knowing the purpose behind all events. There are no punishments after death, and all consequences exist only in relative experience, not in the realm of the absolute. Human theologies are mankind's insane attempt to explain an insane God who does not exist. The only way human theologies make sense is if we accept a God who makes no sense at all. How's that? Another good summary?
Excellent.
Good. Because now I've got a million questions. Why did Hitler go to heaven? I know you just tried to explain this, but somehow I need more. And what is the purpose behind all events? And how does this larger purpose relate to Hitler and other despots?
Let's go to purpose first. All events, all experiences, have as their purpose the creating of opportunity. Events and experiences are opportunities, nothing more, nothing less. It would be a mistake to judge them as works of the devil, punishments from God, rewards from heaven, or anything in between. They are simply events and experiences, things that happen. It is what we think of them, do about them, be in response to them, that gives them meaning. Events and experiences are opportunities drawn to you, created by you individually or collectively through consciousness. Consciousness creates experience. You are attempting to raise your consciousness. You have drawn these opportunities to you in order that you might use them as tools in the creation and experiencing of who you are. Who you are is a being of higher consciousness than you are now exhibiting. Because it is my will that you should know and experience who you are, I allow you to draw to yourself whatever event or experience you choose to create in order to do that. Other players in the universal game join you from time to time, either as brief encounters, peripheral participants, temporary teammates, long-term interactors, relatives and family, dearly loved ones, or life path partners. These souls are drawn to you by you. You are drawn to them by them. It is a mutually creative experience expressing the choices and desires of both. No one comes to you by accident. There is no such thing as coincidence. Nothing occurs at random. Life is not a product of chance. Events, like people, are drawn to you, by you, for your own purposes. Larger planetary experiences and developments are the result of group consciousness. They are drawn to your group as a whole, as a result of the choices and desires of the group as a whole.
What do you mean by the term, your group?
Group consciousness is something that is not widely understood. Yet it is extremely powerful and can, if you're not careful, often overcome individual consciousness. You must always, therefore, endeavor to create group consciousness wherever you go and with whatever you do, if you wish your larger life experience on the planet to be harmonious. If you are in a group whose consciousness does not reflect your own, and you are unable at this time to effectively alter the group consciousness, it is wise to leave the group. Or the group could lead you. It will go where it wants to go, regardless of where you want to go. If you cannot find a group whose consciousness matches your own, be the source of one. Others of like consciousness will be drawn to you. Individuals in smaller groups must affect larger groups, and ultimately the largest group of all, which is all humankind, for there to be permanent and significant change on your planet. Your world and the condition it is in is a reflection of the total combined consciousness of everyone living there. As you can see by looking around you, much work is left to be done. Unless, of course, you are satisfied with your world as it is. Surprisingly, most people are. That is why the world does not change. Most people are satisfied with a world in which differences, not similarities, are honored. And disagreements are settled by conflict and war. Most people are satisfied with a world in which survival is for the fittest, might is right, competition is required, and winning is called the highest good. If such a system happens also to produce losers, so be it, so long as you are not among them. Most people are satisfied, even though such a model produces people who are often killed when they are judged wrong, starved and rendered homeless when they are losers, oppressed and exploited when they are not strong. Most people define wrong as that which is different from them. Religious differences in particular are not tolerated, nor are many social, economic, or cultural differences. Exploitation of the underclass is justified by the self-congratulatory pronouncements from the upper class of how much better off their victims are now than they were before these exploitations. By this measure, the upper class can ignore the issue of how all people ought to be treated if one were being truly fair, rather than merely making a horrible situation a tiny bit better and profiting obscenely in the bargain. Most people laugh when one suggests any kind of system other than the one currently in place, saying that behaviors such as competing and killing and the victor taking the spoils are what makes this civilization great. Most people even think there is no other natural way to be, that it is the nature of humans to behave in this manner, and that to act any other way would kill the inner spirit that drives man to succeed. No one asks the question, succeed at what? Difficult as it is for truly enlightened beings to understand, most people on your planet believe in this philosophy, and that is why most people don't care about the suffering masses, the oppression of minorities, the anger of the underclass, or the survival needs of anyone but themselves and their immediate families. Most people do not see that they are destroying their Earth, the very planet which gives them life, because their actions seek only to enhance their quality of life. Amazingly, they are not farsighted enough to observe that short-term gains can produce long-term losses, and often do, and will. Most people are threatened by group consciousness, a concept such as the collective good, a one-world overview, or a God who exists in unity with all creation rather than separate from it. This fear of anything leading to unification and your planet's glorification of all that separates produce division, disharmony, discord. Yet you do not seem to have the ability even to learn from your own experience, and so you continue your behaviors with the same results. The inability to experience the suffering of another as one's own is what allows such suffering to continue. Separation breeds indifference, false superiority. Unity produces compassion, genuine equality. The events which occur on your planet, which have occurred regularly for 3,000 years, are, as I've said, a reflection of the collective consciousness of your group, the whole group on your planet. That level of consciousness could best be described as primitive.
Yes. But we seem to have digressed here from the original question.
Not really. You asked about Hitler. The Hitler experience was made possible as a result of group consciousness. Many people want to say that Hitler manipulated a group, in this case his countrymen, through the cunning and the mastery of his rhetoric. But this conveniently lays all the blame at Hitler's feet, which is exactly where the mass of people want it. But Hitler could do nothing without the cooperation and support and willing submission of millions of people. The subgroup, which called itself Germans, must assume an enormous burden of responsibility for the Holocaust, as must, to some degree, the larger group called humans, which, if it did nothing else, allowed itself to remain indifferent and apathetic to the suffering in Germany until it reached so massive a scale that even the most cold-hearted isolationists could no longer ignore it. You see, it was collective consciousness which provided fertile soil for the growth of the Nazi movement. Hitler seized the moment, but he did not create it. It's important to understand the lesson here. A group consciousness which speaks constantly of separation and superiority produces loss of compassion on a massive scale, and loss of compassion is inevitably followed by loss of conscience. A collective concept rooted in strict nationalism ignores the plights of others, yet makes everyone else responsible for yours, thus justifying retaliation, rectification, and war. Auschwitz was the Nazi solution to an attempt to rectify the Jewish problem. The horror of the Hitler experience was not that he perpetrated it on the human race, but that the human race allowed him to. The astonishment is not only that a Hitler came along, but also that so many others went along. The shame is not only that Hitler killed millions of Jews, but also that millions of Jews had to be killed before Hitler was stopped. The purpose of the Hitler experience was to show humanity to itself.